Okay, well, yeah, let's officially start. So my name is Emily Huffman, and I'm looking forward to getting to know you all during this course. I'm a postdoc at PI. I also have been involved in the SCI program here in the past, but it was all during COVID, so this is my first chance to do some in-person lectures, so that'll be fun. Also on the course are Giuseppe Celeroli. He will be leading the discussion sessions, tutorials, and then also Zhang will be TA, so you'll meet him there as well. So it's a standard format, 14 lectures. My office hours are Friday at 1, but you can see that. Then feel free to drop by my office. It's 224. Interviews, the standard. The non-interview option for this course is going to be a Mathematica notebook to really work on. Well, this Ising model, it's a lattice model, and be able to study it numerically. And there will be two homeworks for the course. We were going to try to get them in on the early end so that you'll then have time to focus on interviews. We have all the interview questions, so they should be out soon. The syllabus says not until, you won't have the full thing till later, but we actually do have everything set now. Yeah, I think that's pretty much it in terms of the standard stuff. Any questions about the course in general? Okay. Well, let's go ahead and start. Before I really get into more technical things, I'm going to give an overview about what I plan on covering in the course and where we want to go with this. And feel free to let me know if there are certain areas that you're interested in exploring as well. I know Francois in the previous lecture was talking about connections between what he's talking about and what I'm talking about. And I think that there's a good opportunity there, so. Okay, overview. So statistical physics, when we're sort of thinking about beginning from the ground up, it's going to involve systems of many particles, and really many particles. It's really how we're going to scale up, to something like 10 to the 23 particles. And so when we look at the course, that's the other thing. Since we're thinking about all of these particles, it really comes down to the assumptions and what is relevant to a particular system that we're studying. So when we think about the statistical mechanics examples that we'll think about through this course, there are going to be some that really can be explained classically, starting classically and then scaling up. So, we only really need classical assumptions to understand ideal gases. And then we're going to talk about phase transitions that are due to thermal fluctuations. And that, again, is going to be a classical phenomenon. But then there are also things that we can study and we'll do to varying degrees. We'll do some sort of quasi-classical with some quantum assumptions and then also fully quantum, which we'll talk about. But there's some that we really need quantum assumptions to really understand. So some examples are going to be the Bose-Einstein condensation, paramagnetism. And then phase transitions as well here. But these are phase transitions that are due to quantum fluctuations. And so we will talk about those at the very end of the course.
Mm-hmm. Please, can you try to increase your handwriting?
Say again?
Can you increase your handwriting? I'm not seeing.
Oh, can I increase the font size? Or sorry, the size of my writing? Absolutely. Let me raise this a little higher too. I'm sort of struggling with the. Yeah, there we go. Okay. As a note, something we will not be talking much about in this course, a little bit when we're discussing the phase transitions, but really the earlier approach to understanding these phenomena was thermodynamics. And it is the process of developing phenomenologically based laws. For these same many particle systems. But you know, they start from macroscopic data. Which, you know, this is some of the first sorts of laws you probably saw maybe in chemistry and whatnot. You have things like Boyle's law, Charles' law. You know, these end up giving you the ideal gas law, which we can now get through statistical mechanics. And various empirical laws. So as a note, all these thermodynamic relations that were found and that are going to be useful for this course, and also the basic laws of thermodynamics, you will find these on the course website in the appendix. So you can get the thermodynamic relations in the appendix. Okay, and then for statistical physics, we're going to derive these laws from the ground up. So to do that, we're going to need to develop the proper machinery to do this. We can't just solve systems of, you know, thousands, and I'm saying thousands, but really, you know, 10 to the 23, I can't really even comprehend all these equations by hand. And so I got this from David Tong, but there's this great quote by Feynman that goes, anyone who wants to analyze the properties of matter in a real problem might want to start by writing down the fundamental equations and then try to solve them mathematically. Although there are people who try to use such an approach, these people are failures in the field. So And yeah, I mean, we are going to start with these equations because there are some things we can learn from the general form of them. But ultimately, this really is sort of the art of appropriate approximations and asymptotics. And I think that's some of the most challenging part of the field, figuring out, what is really the important attributes of this system that will determine the behavior when we scale up. Okay, so for this course, we're going to start, the first week is going to be a review of really statistical mechanics as used to study gases, so weakly interacting particles. But from there, we're going to turn up the interaction strength. And so we're going to focus mainly on phase transitions. Because once you have a problem and you can increase the interaction strength, or really in the first part of the course, or for most of it, lower the temperature, you can then find that due to these interactions, we get different phases depending on what our temperature is. And so we're going to start with the thermodynamic approach for those phase transitions with the van der Waals model, which is an empirical model. And then we'll go to the statistical approaches. And so starting with mean field theory, and then going to renormalization group. I realize I've been in front of this board for a while. So. Okay, and so really as we take this trip through the learning how to study phase transitions, this is going to take us to statistical field theory. Which in the context of this course will really mean Euclidean field theories. So as you have been doing in QFT, you see path integrals, and there's something like a partition function, or I think of it as a partition function, but path integral in general with an action, e to the I over h bar integral of a Lagrangian. What we are going to be focused on, which I'm calling a statistical field theory, though really you can think about all of these in the context of either sense, but we're going to spend most of the time, well, all of the time for these field theories, thinking about Euclidean path integrals. So here, instead of I over h bar, I'm thinking in terms of a beta, so that's an inverse temperature. This is a Euclidean action we can sort of represent as an F because it's going to be coming from the free energy. So we'll talk about the connections there. And really, these field theories, they originally come from microscopic models, which are how do all these particles interact with each other. And so there are many, many types of statistical field theories out there that could be interesting in one context or another, depending on the critical phenomena that you're interested in. Okay. And one of the last things. So how do we get there? Well, we will start with a lattice, or these are often called microscopic model. And then we will use something called a Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. To take us to a scalar field theory in this case. And then we can define it in the continuum at that point. And really there's active study in the research community using both of these approaches. So when you have these field theories really in the continuum, you know, you can study them using perturbative expansions. Such as ones that are about 4 minus epsilon, which we'll talk about later on, and large N. And these really help us to learn analytically about the field theory. On the other hand, when you start with these lattice microscopic models, the lattice is really a regulator for your theory. And in this case, you can learn about the theory too by taking larger and larger lattices. You use something called finite size scaling. And this really allows you to learn about field theories too, but you learn from numerics in this case. Because you have discrete degrees of freedom, this works well for putting something into a computer. And so this is actually what my research is related to. So I do a lot of study, particular fermionic theories on lattices and understanding another aspect called universality. So what we're going to find is that when we look at a particular lattice microscopic model, it's actually going to be one that's called the Ising model. I'm going to go ahead and move this up to make sure that you can see things. So you have something that we're going to study, the three-dimensional Ising model. And this was, again, defined on the lattice. And then we're also going to study a field theory called phi-4 theory. And I think there's a good chance Francois will talk about this theory later on in his course as well. And what we're going to do then is we're going to use renormalization group to study them. And what we're going to do is we're going to find that these theories, and you don't have to understand this yet, but there's something called a renormalization group flow. They're going to flow to the same fixed point. And this is the same as saying that they are going to flow, they are going to be in the same universality class. Which is also saying that they have, they're going to correspond to a continuous phase transition that has the same critical exponents or scaling dimensions. And so I'm sort of giving you the spoilers at the beginning so that you have an idea of what we're working toward. Later on in the course, when we get to renormalization group, it will be very heavy in terms of really filling in all the details for the math and whatnot. So it's good to see where we're headed. So yeah, in summary, sort of the learning outcomes, I guess, is really just to learn various tools for studying these many particle systems. So I would say, you know, we're going to start out with finding tools for getting average observables. And we'll get there with ensembles. We're going to learn about states and phases. And so part of the tools there are about figuring out how to build order parameters. Because an order parameter tells you something about your state or your phase. Or also, you know, pure versus mixed states. Tool to figure out if you have a pure versus mixed state. And that's useful for quantum information applications as well. And then phase transitions, how to study those. So really learning RG. And then finally, just regulating theories through the lattice. And then that will bring me to my last topic in the course, which is not something that'll be in the interviews, but just something to understand. You may, there's been a recent activity at PI involving Yin Chen and me and some others called the fuzzy sphere. And it's another way of regulating without other than the lattice. So I'm just going to have a bonus lecture on that. So it's a different regulator tool that also works well for numerics because it involves discrete degrees of freedom. And the plus side of it is that it's very simple to detect whether you have an emergent conformal symmetry in a theory. Okay, so that's my overview. And we'll actually get into specifics now. But before I go there, any questions, any discussion, comments? Yep.
You said that the 5-4 theorem, the 3D Eisele model flow to the same fixed point and that they belong to the same universality class. Is this a definition? So when two theories flow to the same fixed point, they belong to the same universality class, or is it a consequence of their sibling related in another way?
Yeah, it's just another way of saying it, basically. They really are, yeah, if you have, so both of these theories, they have a continuous phase transition, and they have a quantum critical point. That quantum critical point has a critical exponents for that transition, and they match for the two of them. So we say they're in the same universality class because of that. It's really about that critical point. Now, I said 3D Ising model. So this is actually the phase transition that's in temperature, the finite temperature phase transition. but yeah, so they, if they flow to the same fixed point, yeah, then you say at the at criticality they're in the same universality class.
Mm-hmm. Does 5-4 in like a different dimension flow, for example, to two-dimensionalizing model or something like that?
Oh, I see. You're saying in if we look at other couplings. And, oh yeah, yeah. Because I'm assuming a certain. Yeah, I'm assuming three dimensions here. I guess that. So you're saying in two dimensions, does it also? I don't know that. I don't know whether it does. Or not. Okay. Oh, that one's at the very back. Okay, so we're going to begin with a classical system of many particles. And I am going to start by giving, you know, all those equations. Of course, we're not going to stand here and solve them all, but we will see what the equations are, and then we're going to see what we can learn from their form, basically. So to do that, it's useful to have a phase space formalism. So we're going to start with our n particles, big N particles. I'm just going to kind of put four of them representatively. And we're just going to say, hey, we have four particles, and they're each going to have some kind of position, which I'm going to call Q, use Qs to represent the position. And I'm going to, since I'm on a board and it's 2D, I'm just going to say it's in two dimensions. So there's some position here, and this one has some momentum too, with two components. Same thing for this one. Position, momentum. Have this one going this way, position, momentum, and then finally just have this one going this way. Just arbitrary position and momentum. Okay, so then we're going to say a state or configuration is going to be defined by some, you know, large, I'm just going to call it some QP type of vector that really is, you know, if we have n particles, we're going to have 2n q components. We're going to have 2n p components. So we're going to have 4n components here. So this would be like q1, q2, up to q2n, p1, p2, all the way to p2n. So then, so we've talked about where it is, what the system looks like in this moment. But then we've got to actually define something about, you know, what is the physics of the system? And so, the physics of the system are going to be specified by Hamiltonian. So this is just going to be h, which is going to be a function of q and p. And it could be time dependent. I'll just keep things general here. Okay, so, well, you took classical physics earlier this year. You know you've got these position momentum, you know you've got the Hamiltonian. So how do you figure out how, you know, one of these particles or all these particles would evolve in time for just doing the straightforward thing? What do you use?
Laplace equations for one.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so then we can describe the trajectories of all these points simply by writing down Hamilton's equations. Well, and not really describe, but we can give the things that would describe the trajectories of all these points. So we've got q dot I, you know, for this ith component is equal to partial h, partial pi, qt, p of t, t, and then p dot I is equal to minus this. Okay, and then, you know, we've got some initial conditions too. You can say that q of zero is just, we'll call it q zero. P at t equals zero is just, we'll call it p zero. Or. Okay. So, you know, this is how the particles evolve, but like we mentioned, we don't actually want to solve all these equations. And moreover, that doesn't necessarily help us. If we knew the location of every particle at every single time, what does that really tell us anything about, you know, the macroscopic world that we'd be interested in? You know, so what are we actually interested in? What are the types of things we'd be interested in at the macro level, you know? If we think about like some type of material or something like that, or some sort of fluid or gas or anything.
Density.
Mm-hmm. Sure, density.
Temperature, pressure.
Yep, temperature, pressure, you know, all these things that, like we were talking about with thermodynamics. You know, what about if something is magnetic, right? It'd be nice to know if something's magnetic. You know, a whole bunch of condensed matter is interested in, does something conduct? And so this really means computing averages for different observables of interest. Actually, I think this one looks easier to erase. Okay, so to do this, we were talking about sort of the states of all the particles and where they were. Now let me go ahead and put this, put this front. Because I covered up two boards, I guess. That one doesn't, okay. Oh, here we go. Here's the one that's missing. And so really what we end up developing is a distinction between microstates and macrostates. So microstates are simply defined. We already said exactly what they were. This Q, P, the precise positions and momenta of each particle. And then we have macrostates, on the other hand, which are really what we are interested in at the macro level. And so here we have the information about the macroscopic quantities, where we have our temperature, energy of the system, magnetization, and then it often includes many microstates, right? And so when we're thinking about this, let's define a phase space, because that's where I said we were starting. We have a phase space that I'm going to call M, and I'll be using this notation throughout. So M is going to be your total phase space, where every point is like some Q and P value in this phase space. And so, you know, this one is, you know, a microstate. So then if we're thinking more formally now, a macrostate can be defined as it's a way to assign a weight, which we'll be using the symbol rho for, to each microstate. And so then, so we use rho of QP for this, which I also might call a density function. And when we get to the quantum version of this, it's a density matrix. Okay, so now let's get sort of concrete. Think about discrete systems is how I'll start. And I'm just going to think about a system that has a few different discrete energies. So really, this is like sort of modeling a quantum mechanical system, but in a pseudo-classical way. So let's say we have E1, E2, E3, and so on. This is a spectrum. And at each energy level, we have a certain number of particles that I'm going to call little n1, little n2, et cetera. N1, n2, n3. And so then we have quantities like the total number of particles is just going to be the sum of the particles at each energy state. And then the total energy is going to be the sum of the number of particles in each energy state times their the energy of that particular state. And so, you know, in this example, we would say E, whatever this total energy is, this big energy specifies a macro state. Whereas, you know, a particular set of NIs, where I say I have one here, three here, two there, et cetera, that's going to specify a microstate. So as an example, and I'm just going to go back to something that I'm sure you saw at the beginning when you were thinking about macrostates and microstates and whatnot. Imagine you had some system. It's kind of silly to think about, but it has different energies, but you sort of organize it according to the ways that coins can land, heads or tails. So suppose we had, you know, four coins, and we say if it's heads, then each of those heads is worth some energy epsilon. And if it's tails, each of the tails is worth just zero. So then for the macro state, 2 epsilon, how many microstates are there? You want to get the full energy to equal 2 epsilon, and you know you have these coins lined up in a row. You know how many ways can you go in?
Six,
exactly. Yeah, because we are going to have, you know, these coins. This would be one of the examples, and there are going to be 6 ways because it's basically, you know, 4 choose 2. You need two heads, two tails, but the order, this is indistinguishable from that. And so then we can think about this row I was talking about, density function really for the continuum, but if we're thinking about sort of frequencies, we can define this function. So what would rho for zero energy be? How many ways would we get zero energy from these coins?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's only one way. That's if they all are tails. And then we have rho of epsilon. Well, we would need one of them to be heads and all the others to be tails, but it could be any 4 of them, right? So rho of epsilon is 4. Rho of 2 epsilon, we already said, was 6. Rho of 3 epsilon, well, what's a fast way to think about what rho of 3 epsilon would be?
One of them to be tails.
yeah, now one of them is tails. So it's basically the same problem, but in the other way. And then rho of 4 epsilon is what? Yeah, it's 1 again. And so, you know, even just looking at this, you know that this 2 epsilon energy sector has more states in it than any of the other ones. So this is going to be a more likely macro state to find yourself in than the other ones. And like I said, we are ultimately interested in calculating averages for observables. So if we want to get the average energy here, well, we just have to do a sum from n equals 0 to n equals 4, because those are all the things we have, of n times epsilon, because that's the energy, times rho epsilon. And then we need to normalize it. And so, you know, you can calculate this, but you're going to get 32 epsilon over 16, or 2 epsilon as your average energy of the system. Which, when you look at this and you see the symmetry of it, it is not too surprising that, right, that you would see an average energy of 2 epsilon. You have both of these higher and lower by an epsilon with equal frequencies, both of these higher and lower by 2 epsilon with frequency, and so on. So the point is, we were able to use this rho, which gave really the definition of our microstate, including the value of the particular macrostate, and we can compute its average. And that tells us something about this very small system. Okay, so that was for the discrete energies. For a classical system with continuous energies, let's go back to the microstate, which was the Q and P. Okay, let's say continuous. Continuous states, basically. And so then we say a macro state, because this is a notation I'll be using later on, can be defined with this measure, because we're dealing with continuous variables. So no more summations. We're going to have an integral instead, which is d mu equals rho of q p, where we have a continuous function now, dq n dn p. And so I might use this as a shorthand sometimes in these integrals. And this is not something that we will necessarily normalize. It's simpler just to keep it this way, and then we can always normalize at the end you know, just like I did over there when I divided by everything. So, you know, then we can get average values. So if we want the average value of some quantity A, we're going to do an integral over M, A QP d mu over an integral also over M. M was our full phase space to recall up there, d mu. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, well, let's take a short couple minute break and then I'll move on to Liouville's theorem. I know that your morning is just full of lectures, so.
Emily,
mm-hmm.
Another question.
Yeah.
So in this continuous case,
mm-hmm.
In general, how do you find the probability rho? Do they give it to you, or is it like?
Yeah. So it depends on. Yeah, we'll talk about how to get these rows, because we get these through different ensembles and whatnot. Now, if you're doing something, you can actually study some quantum systems using this too, even though it's continuous, either as an approximation, which we'll see for like the Bose-Einstein condensation for proving some things there, or also you could do this. This row could be something like, what's it called? It's like a Dirac measure, where
okay.
It's really only equal to one at these
yeah.
discrete sort of things.
Okay.
So.
Does it sometimes happen that this integral like goes to infinity or something, that it just like blows up?
I see, yeah. So one of the things we do for sure is here, we define this such that this part doesn't blow up, this is defined to be finite. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are, devious ways you could make observables that are poorly behaved and whatnot. I think generally with our physical quantities here in Euclidean space, it's generally well defined, but yeah. Okay, we'll start again at 45. Okay. So Liouville's theorem. I gave you all the equations at the beginning, and then I introduced some other quantities to think about, like the phase space and the macrostates and the microstates. And so basically, now we're ready to learn something about rho from Hamilton's equations. Okay, so to recall, we still got them up on the board over on the right-hand side. And so now we're going to concern ourselves with our particular integral, thinking in terms of this continuous row that we have. Okay, so for a region U, which is just some portion of the M of the phase space, we are going to look at then integral over U, this rho of X, and we'll just to be completely general, think about a rho with an X and a T dependence. Oh, and I did not define this D to the 2n X yet. So let me do that. Collect another eraser over here. So X is just going to be equal to that Q1, Q2, Q2, and in fact, I'm just going to say have it go up to N now. P1, P2, to Pn. So X is just going to be this long vector, and I'm just going to have it to go up to N, so it's D to the 2nx.
Sorry, Emily.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any complications with defining a measure here? Because
this object x lives in like both the tangent and the cotangent space, or admits both elements. So.
I see. Yeah, we don't. And to be honest, I'm not the best one to ask about that sort of question. So we are thinking still entirely in terms of Euclidean space. So for one thing, all these numbers are basic, that might be a good question for Giuseppe, actually. Okay. So now we're going to examine the derivative of this quantity. And here I want to make my make one note. If we are going to assume equilibrium, which we do for most systems for this course, equilibrium, it is going to be the case that partial rho, partial t, is equal to zero. There's going to be no time dependence for rho in an equilibrium situation. But for now, we'll just keep things the way they are. Are there any, I heard some discussion. Okay, so then for trajectories, we're going to have that we can rewrite this ddt of rho xt d2nx. We can rewrite this as an integral where instead of integrating over u, we're going to integrate over the boundary of u. So I'm going to use this du, partial u, to represent the boundary of the integral. Then I'm going to have rho of x times a velocity times a normal, and I'll talk about each of these things. So if I think about my phase space, M, and then I think about some portion of it in here that's U, then this normal is simply going to be arrows going outwards. So this is your n vector. You're integrating around the boundary, rho x, and then these are the velocities, really the q dot and p dot of all your coordinates. And so really what this is doing is this is a way to measure the flux through this. So if this quantity is zero and it's not changing in time, that's saying that the trajectories in here are, there's not going to be net trajectories going out or in inside this boundary space. And so this is really sort of thinking about the points and how they would move. And now there's a minus sign here because, so the normal is defined this way. If we had points going outward, then that would be like removing flux from inside here. And so that would be a negative change in this volume that we have.
Last question, I'll consider an equilibrium.
So we haven't made an assumption about equilibrium.
Oh, but like y rho is no longer time dependent.
Oh yeah, yeah, we could keep it.
What does velocity mean here? Is it just actual velocity of the particle?
Yes, this is just, so this is when you think about the particles, you had the Hamilton's equations, this is actually your Q dot and your V dot. This is really like a general X dot vector because the X referred to all of these pieces here.
Mm-hmm. Is there also like B dot in this V?
Yes, there is. Okay. Okay, so we had this, you know, boundary integral that we rewrote it as. So now we really have the setup where we can apply the divergence theorem. We have this minus integral du rho rho of xt v of xt dotted with this normal and then this, you know, dA patch really of a surface area. And so when we apply the divergence theorem, we say that this is equal to the divergence of rho v, which I'm just going to write without the coordinates for now. And so, you know, it really is kind of a divergence theorem, which you've seen, I guess, in electricity and magnetism. I'm not sure if you've taken that course here, but anyway, you know, the sum of all the sources of a field in a region will give the flux outside of the region. And I have something off with the sign. I think the one should be plus and one should be. No, never mind. The sign is correct. Okay. So now if I go back, remember, I've moved to this quantity using the divergence theorem. But originally what it was equal to was this quantity. And so what we can do at this point is we can write this. We can combine the two and say, and we can say a partial rho, partial t, because we can bring that integral, that derivative inside there. These coordinates are separate from the time. And we can say this plus this divergence to rho times, not big V, sorry, rho times the velocity, which is a vector, d2n x is equal to 0. So I got this expression just from what we had at the beginning to what we got from the divergence theorem. But when we were thinking about all these manipulations, we haven't said anything about U. U is arbitrary. So we can actually list this equation, which is the continuity equation, which you also see in fluid mechanics. So instead of a fluid, though, flowing around, what we have are these points in our phase space that have trajectories, and they flow around. And so this equation really governs how they can move. So yeah, the trajectory points behave like a fluid in our phase space. Okay. So now, and I had this question about what is VT. So let's be more specific about what this velocity is. We haven't yet used any of our information because we know that our trajectories are governed by Hamilton's equations, but we haven't actually used that piece yet in this exploration. Okay. This one seems a little lighter. Okay. Maybe it's just the color. Okay, so what is this velocity? Okay. Well, I can rewrite the Hamilton's equations that we have up here. I'm just going to rewrite it using this long vector that I have over here. So I can rewrite this as a multiplication of a matrix. Using my vector, where this is what the matrix is. I'm going to define J to be a matrix that involves blocks. So I have an identity for n particles here, a minus identity for n particles here. And then the point is that I'm going to mix the Q's and the P's with each other. Because that's what we have up here, right? The Q derivative is related, sorry, yeah, the Q time derivative is related to the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to P. The P time derivative is related to the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to Q. And that one has a minus sign. So we're going to mix the Q's and P's. Just an example. Let's just look at one of these. Let's say we'd want x dot 1. You know, that is going to be equal to, well, Q dot 1. And that is going to be equal, using this mixing matrix, to dx n plus 1, because that's going to bring us over to this other one, which should be dh over dp1 instead. Because you've got x1 to n should be your q's, xn plus 1 to 2n should be your p's. So this is just a way to combine them all into one equation here. Okay, so if we do that, we can say that VA of XT is equal to this same thing. This is what we're going to use for our B, for our V expression. Okay, so we have V. Now, when we look at this equation, we know we're going to need a couple of things. We have this divergence. We're going to need to get at, you know, the derivatives of these couple of things. I'm going to start with the divergence of V alone, because we will need that anyway. So let's just take this in parts. And then let's leave this board up here, since that's our starting point. Okay. So what is this divergence of V? Well, we can get the divergence of V. We can write it, and I'm just going to write this summation explicitly, partial of V with respect to these XA coordinates. But then we can use this expression for V that we got here, and we can put it in there. So that is going to be equal to some, this part is the same, but then I need to multiply. So here's my V quantity, and since it involved its own matrix multiplication, we now have both A and B in this sum. Okay, but then I want you to notice something. If you take JAB, that's the same as minus GBA, right? Because that's just taking this entry, which would map over to some entry over here. So that means this is an anti-symmetric matrix. So we could also say, you know, this is equal to minus J BA, and then this still looks slightly different, but then we can we should be able to right. So did I do that correctly? Or no, I think because I didn't, because this is just showing the same. It should be the case that this is actually equal to minus itself. Maybe because if you do Anyone? Yeah.
Derivatives will mute. So the other matrix is.
Oh, right. The derivatives. Yes, yes. So we can switch these order, right? Right. So you know, I'm just going to switch the order of these two. And then you see, hey, these are dummy variables. So you can just rewrite this with AA and BB. And so really, this is equal to minus itself. And so that means that this expression, this divergence, is equal to 0. OK. So with that, then, we can look at this full piece, the divergence of rho v. And from here, we get the sum of A. Rho v A. And then we know that we have two derivatives, but the divergence of v by itself was equal to 0. So now we can just write it as derivative A d rho dx A times v A. And so then we can put in our expression for the velocity again that we have, summation over AB d rho over dxA JAB dH dxB. And then it turns out when you do that, what you just get is the Poisson bracket of H, of rho and H, where just so that you have this notation here, the Poisson bracket is defined to be d rho dqi dh dpi minus d rho dpi dh dqi. And so you really just get that from this connection matrix, because we know it connected p and q, and you have the minus sign. Okay, so now we're ready for the final expression for this. Okay, where we showed at the very top, we have d rho dt plus the divergence of rho v, but we just showed divergence of rho v is the Poisson bracket. So we have d rho dt plus Poisson bracket of rho and h is equal to 0. And this is Liouville's equation. And then in the case of equilibrium, which is where we'll be spending most, if not all, of our time, we might do some non-equilibrium for one example. But for the most part, we're going to get that this part is 0. So we're just going to have the Poisson bracket of rho and h is equal to 0. And this is really the important thing that we have learned about our form of rho, because this really limits the types of things that types of forms that rho can take. We will discuss that in a lot more detail tomorrow, but as a brief preview, you could have rho equals constant, for example, because that is something that would definitely satisfy this. And the rho is constant solution is what gives us the microcanonical ensemble. In the other cases, I mean, this is a completely generic statement. So really what we have is that we must have rho equals some function of the Hamiltonian. You know, it's really only in terms of the Hamiltonian. And so then what we'll get is, you know, rho of, let's say, QP are going to be equal to exponentials related to H. And these sorts of things, which could involve other terms, let me just keep it kind of generic, are going to be what gives you the canonical and grand canonical ensembles. But this is the stuff that we will get into tomorrow. All right, any questions? Feel free to come up to me and I will see you later. I see you tomorrow.